society.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and get here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
And welcome to What's Going On. I'm Rebecca Miles, a reporter and producer and host of Wednesday's What's Going On. On the show today, we talked to journalist Caleb Maupin about China. Caleb is a journalist and political analyst and frequently appears on RT International. He writes on American foreign policy and is the creator and founder of the Center for Political Innovation. Also on the show, poet and activist Eileen Miles, one of the lead members of a group, East River Park Action, fighting to stop the city from destroying the only park on the Lower East Side. We'll throw now to Pacifica National Newscast for some of the news highlights this morning.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. California's recall election went off smoothly despite fires, false allegations of fraud, and the ongoing and exacerbated challenges of voting during a pandemic. Governor Gavin Newsom bested 46 candidates, including his top challenger, conservative radio host and avid Trump supporter Larry Elder. Governor Newsom is expected to run for a second term. His current term ends in January 2023.
No one has been turned away from being able to vote, and we believe that every Californian who wanted to vote has had an opportunity to do so.
California Secretary of State Shirley Weber told the New York Times there were no lines at polling places to speak of. Phones were answered throughout the entire process, and ballots were sent to everyone, including those in fire zones. Voting should be easier, according to Congresswoman Amy Klobuchar. She joined several other Democrats to introduce the Freedom to Vote Act on Tuesday, which she says expands access to the ballot.
It makes sure that people can vote regardless of their zip code, in the way that they want to vote, that's safe. And finally, it includes really important provisions to stop gerrymandering.
The bill sets national standards for early voting, allows all voters to request a mail-in ballot, and makes Election Day a national holiday.
This is a moment when our democracy picks itself up, brushes off the dust, and moves forward as America always does. Going forward as a nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All 50 Senate Democrats are now on board with the watered-down legislation. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer plans to hold a vote next week. For the first time since taking office, President Biden's approval ratings have dropped into negative territory. According to a new Quinnipiac University poll, 42% of Americans approved of Biden's overall performance, while 50% disapproved. Biden's ratings on issues like COVID-19 are about even. However, on foreign policy, just 34% approve, compared to 44% prior to the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Today, President Biden stopped by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory Flatirons campus outside of Denver, where he said, "We can't wait any longer to take action on climate change, and that means promoting renewables like solar and wind."
We don't have a lot of time. We don't have much more than 10 years, for real. And this is a decisive decade. Already the price of solar generation in this country has dropped 80% over the past decade. And today, renewables are now cheaper than fossil fuels in many parts of the country.
The president added, nearly one in three Americans live in communities that have been struck by a weather disaster in just the past few months. I'm Suzanne Potter for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
That was Susan Potter for the Pacifica National Newscast. Thank you for that. And now over to Angela for traffic and weather.
Good morning. Commuters can expect a smooth trip this morning as no active delays are reported on any subway lines right now. We'll keep an eye out on that for you to see if anything changes. For the LIRR, there are no delays being reported at this time. Today, extra service will be added for customers leaving work in the early afternoon in observance of Yom Kippur. 10 additional eastbound trains will depart Penn Station between 12:43 p.m. and 3:48 p.m., and one local train to Hicksville will be extended to Huntington. For bridge and tunnel traffic, the Lincoln and Holland tunnels are both experiencing heavier delays headed into the city this morning. There's bumper-to-bumper traffic on the GW headed north on both the upper and lower levels. Construction continues on the Verrazano Bridge today, so be prepared for traffic to slow down if you're headed that way this morning. We're seeing backups on both the Whitestone and the Throgs Neck Bridges. For road traffic, the LIE is experiencing heavy backups headed westbound, starting in Suffolk and leading all the way into Queens. The Staten Island Expressway going onto the Verrazano is experiencing heavy traffic as well, leading onto the Gowanus Expressway. There's heavy traffic in the Bronx this morning on the Bruckner Expressway headed west, the Cross Bronx headed south, and the Major Deegan headed south. If you can, take the clear view this morning if you're headed that way. The Cross Island headed north is experiencing some delays. Finally, for today's weather, it's mostly sunny with a high near 84 and humidity around 86%. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms are possible before 10 p.m. with a low around 71. Thursday, there's a chance of showers with thunderstorms also possible after 4 p.m. with a high near 76.
Thank you, Angela Palumo, for traffic and weather. That was David Bowie with Little China Girl. It's 7:08 on Wednesday morning. I'm Rebecca Miles with What's Going on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. So what should we think about China? That's one of our questions this morning. Our guest will explore the answer with us. Caleb Maupin is a journalist and political analyst who frequently appears on RT International. He writes on American foreign policy and is the creator and founder of the Center for Political Innovation. He streams daily on YouTube. He's written several books, among them The Bread Tube Serves Imperialism, Examining the New Brand of Internet Pseudo-Socialism, Kamala Harris and the Future of America, an essay in three parts, and provided the introduction for The Green Book by Muammar Gaddafi. Welcome to the show, Caleb.
Sure. Glad to be here.
So if we could start with China, it's about half, certainly the most arable land is about half the size of the US, where 1 billion people live. It's managed to lift out 850 million Chinese out of poverty over the period of its industrial revolution. I think that's probably the accurate way to describe what's going on. So why does China matter?
Well, I would say that Winston Churchill, he once described the Soviet Union. He said it's a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside of an enigma. And it's important for us to look at China, as you said, a billion people, the most populous country in the world, the largest creator of steel in the world. Half the steel in the world is created in China, the world's largest telecommunications manufacturer, the center of some of the most important fusion energy research that's happening. And while we look at China, we don't seem to be able to understand it. It doesn't fit into any of the categories by which we generally understand things politically or geopolitically in the United States. And I think that the conversation around China is very confused. It's very highly politicized. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of attack. There's a lot of panic. But at the end of the day, there's not a lot of clear-headed thinking. And I hope that conversation can change, because China is going to be something we have to deal with for a long time.
Well, what do you mean by deal with? What are you talking about there specifically?
Well, if you read the novels of Pearl Buck, if you look at what China was just 30, 40, 50 years ago, we were dealing with one of the poorest countries in the world. But now, in a lot of ways, you could say China has pulled itself up by its bootstraps. The industrialization process, raising people out of poverty, creating a new middle class of people that are living very comfortably. Before the pandemic, the world tourism industry was having a big shift due to the number of tourists, people whose grandparents and parents may have been living in the countryside, may have been illiterate, are now going on vacation to places like Paris and London and the Caribbean. And China is becoming more and more of a factor in the world now. And we're going to have a relationship with them on the global stage. And when you look at situations like Africa, and when you look at situations like the South China Sea, when you look at situations like the telecommunications market, the computer revolution, you look at the fact that Hollywood is increasingly having to make their movies to appeal to Chinese audiences. China is something that is becoming more and more of a factor. And if we just approach it in a kind of fear-based way, we're not going to have any success. They're going to be somebody that we're going to have to do business with. They're going to be someone that we're going to have to deal with on the international stage. And we need to do it from a place of understanding and recognition that they will be there. They're not just going to disappear, and they're not just going to give up their increasing chunk on the world market. So how do we deal with them as a competitor, as a potential ally, as a potential friend, as a potential business partner, as a partner in the international community?
Well, we certainly saw during the Trump administration was tariffs on trade, sanctions. Is this going to work, where the country not only has to consider the US interests, but it shares the border with North Korea, Russia, Mongolia, Kazakhstan, India, Burma, Laos, Vietnam? The country has a lot of considerations. So what about this sort of dynamic between the US and China, when it also has issues on several of its borders?
You know, when I was in Sochi, Russia, at the Valdi Discussion Club, which is a very important think tank, I heard from various world leaders, including Russian leader Vladimir Putin, as well as Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba. And when I was there, we also heard from Aysel Toji, who is the head of the Norwegian Nobel Prize Committee. And Aysel Toji described how in Eurasia, in Central Asia, in Russia and in China, in many regions, this is a golden era. Many people are getting access to electricity and running water for the first time. Railway is granting access to previously isolated regions. And there's really a huge amount of economic expansion going on. I mean, if you want to hear more about that, listen to what was said by the Russian and Chinese leaders at the Economic Forum in Vladivostok, and listen to what's going on. There is a huge amount of expansion going on in this part of the world. When you look at your map, and when you look at what you can call Eurasia, when you look at Central Asia, when you look at Siberia, Mongolia, you know, the parts of China that are not close to the Pacific Ocean, but rather more inland, there is a huge amount of expansion and growth happening in that part of the world. And the United States looks on at that. And I think that there's a huge amount of fear. Zbigniew Brzezinski referred to Eurasia as the grand chessboard. And when you talk about the United States pulling out of Afghanistan, when you talk about the increased increased hostility and fear toward China, it's fear that the world is rising out of poverty. Economic growth is taking place. But we in the United States and our big corporations and banks are not really a part of it. There's an alternative world economy emerging. And what China is doing with the Belt and Road Initiative is they are kind of setting up an alternative form of globalization that is very much a threat to the dominance of big banks and corporations in Wall Street and in London that have dominated the world. Globalization in the 1990s meant neoliberalism. Globalization means something very, very different if you look at what China is doing.
Well, let's pick up the Belt and Road Initiative. But and also, if we're talking about a new form of economic global exchange, are we talking about socialism, communism? How does that work with capitalism?
Well, that's the interesting thing. It doesn't fit into Cold War categories specifically. When you talk about socialism in China, they call their system socialism with Chinese characteristics. It's not socialism in the sense that the Soviet Union was. There is a vast market sector. There's a lot of big corporations who make lots of money. There's a lot of inequality. There's a lot of folks who become wealthy. It's socialism in the sense that the economy is not left up to the anarchy of production or the chaos of the market, right? Karl Marx described capitalism as a system where profits are in command. Frederick Engels, he talked about under capitalism, the means of production only function as preliminary transformation into capital. And that capitalism is a system of production organized to make profits for private owners. Well, in China, you've got private owners, but at the end of the day, they don't really have the final say. The Chinese Communist Party and their central plan, they have five-year economic plans, they have the final say. And while you might have a private company, at any point, the Communist Party can come in and tell you how to run it. And that this kind of overall control, where there is central planning, there is overall, central guidance of the economy, there's really no respect for the private property rights of corporations. They are told what to do. They're forced to function in the interest of the Chinese state central plan. In this sense, you can call it socialism. And of course, communism, that is the ultimate vision of a stateless, classless world. Deng Xiaoping, he re-emphasized what Karl Marx wrote about in the Critique of the Goethe Program, which is communism is really only possible with vast material abundance. It is the abundance of material goods that would lay the basis for the breaking down of inequality and the breaking down of the state, et cetera. So their understanding of socialism and communism is very, very different, I would argue, than what we saw with the Soviet Union, what we saw with Cuba and other socialist countries of the 20th century. And furthermore, there's a big revival of Confucianism and traditional Chinese culture in China. And during the 1960s and in the Mao era, in the Cultural Revolution, Confucianism and China's traditional past were seen as kind of at odds with communism. But now you see communism, Mao Zedong thought, Deng Xiaoping theory, kind of walking hand in hand with traditional Chinese culture, with Confucius, with the history of the various dynasties that have ruled, all is what kind of makes China unique and defines their identity as separate from the West. So China is very much a new entity. It's something very different on the global stage, but I would argue that many countries around the world are studying from them. I mean, Vietnam has had huge successes with their market reforms and their central planning, but involvement of private actors. Cuba would like to be more like China. North Korea very much wants to shift their economy to be more like China. They want foreign investment. They want a market sector, but they want to maintain the rule of the Korean Workers' Party. And that China is very much an image of new things to come.
Right. Well, I think we'll take a musical break now to allow listeners to make calls if they have any questions for Caleb Maupin, my guest this morning. The number to call is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. We've been listening to Caleb Maupin a journalist and political analyst and frequent commentator on RT International. So if we go to the music now, that would be great. Bit loud this time of the morning, but that was AC/DC TNT at 7:22. Welcome back to What's Going On. I'm the host, Rebecca Miles. We have on the show this morning Caleb Maupin, a journalist and political analyst, who's just been telling us about China. It's not what we all think it is. It's not the reduced way in which it's reported in the New York Times. It's much more fascinating than that. I believe we don't have any calls at the moment. Maybe it's just it's very, very dense for everybody this morning, but we'll carry on. If there are some calls, we'll patch them in. So, Caleb, if we could return to you. I have a couple of questions under the pandemic, whether the Chinese economy is in trouble. We've seen a lot of decline in really purchasing power, and because everyone was back at, you know, went home if they could work from home, whether that's going to have any effect on the economy and how that squares with their desire to have more equality.
Well, China responded to the pandemic very effectively. They got it before anybody else did, and the party swung into motion. And at the time, you'll recall that Donald Trump said China was doing a great job, and U.S. media portrayed China's measures in response to the pandemic as overly authoritarian. Oh, my goodness, lockdowns, how these people are being locked down. But then at the end of the day, they dealt with it in a much more effective manner than we did. And they were dealing with it before anybody else had it. Meanwhile, over here, we've had many different strategies in many different regions. We have all kinds of debates about, you know, we had a president who couldn't even tell us to wear masks. He wasn't sure that wearing masks was the right thing to do, and many different approaches. And China handled it far more effectively, and their economy is zooming ahead at this point. Now, the slowdown from the West has certainly affected them. They're not selling as many products on the international market as they once were, but they are continuing to move ahead. Meanwhile, our economy, Joe Biden says this is inflation. We should just, it's going to be an adjustment. Don't worry about it. This is just an adjustment. We're just catching up. But a lot of people are looking at the price of food, the price of various commodities rising, amid the fact that, you know, jobs, and there hasn't been a full recovery here. our economy is not doing too well. Meanwhile, China, again, because the party was in control, because you didn't have the anarchy of production, because the economy wasn't just kind of taking care of itself, you did have this central planning, they were able to deal with the pandemic much more effectively.
Right. I believe we do have a caller for the show, Russell from Westchester. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rebecca. I'd like to ask Caleb, he seems to be speaking admiringly of the Chinese economy and the effectiveness of their lockdown. Caleb, tell me if I'm right. The Chinese dealt with their pandemic by locking up the super spreaders, the doctors and nurses that were coming in contact with the patients, right? They locked them all in the hospital, right?
I've heard such things.
Yeah, I've heard that too. And I think the Chinese way of dealing with things is not appropriate to the United States. I think that we here have looked at the Chinese and said, well, they really do everything right. And when they did this thing, we aped it. And it was a big mistake, the biggest mistake in our history. The creativity of the West comes from the chaos of the market. And I think you should think twice about how great China's doing things. They've got a capitalist economy. It's a command and control economy. And doing what they're doing is not good for us. And downplaying Trump, and I'm a Trump voter, but I'm not a Trump follower. He said the biggest thing we have to fear is fear itself. And that's what happened. So I'd like you to reflect with that. Yom Kippur coming on. Thank you very much, Rebecca and Caleb.
Sure. Well, what I think the caller was getting at was that that China has combined the strengths of capitalism with their socialist system. I mean, they do have people starting their own businesses. They do have people with new ideas. But at the same time, the party maintains control, and that has been kind of the strength. It's been that synthesis of the free market with overall state central planning and control. Whereas here in the United States, we're not all on the same page with the pandemic. We haven't had a clear vision. What is the unified vision in the United States? What does it mean to be an American? We're not all on the same page. They seem to be on the same page, and it's a struggle over there to keep them on the same page. And part of the whole thing that with the social credit system is largely an attempt to keep the country on the same page. And there's a lot of confused information about that, and about many things that we hear in American media about China are very, very confused. But they've effectively responded to things like the pandemic by being on the same page, by having guiding unified policies, and they've been able to handle things. Whereas we continue in the United States to operate in a manner of, every individual for themselves, and in some cases, every region for themselves, and the results have not been so good.
Let me just pick up that social credit point you made there, which to us in the West looks like surveillance, although, of course, we are also under surveillance quite heavily. But explain the social credit system, how that works.
Well, the idea is that, some of it is just kind of basic, which is that if you've been fined by the government and you owe huge amounts of money, it gives the Chinese Communist Party the ability to collect the money because there were problems with the fact that there were people who broke the law and were sentenced to a fine and didn't pay it. And so they were able to implement policies where people could actually, face penalties, not be able to book flights and such until they paid their fine. But overall, it was a way to regulate the behavior of this emerging middle class that they're dealing with. I believe in 2017, every day a new Chinese person became a millionaire. There are many Chinese billionaires. And it is a struggle to keep those folks, loyal to the overall vision and for the party to kind of assert control over those folks. And it was implemented. What I find to be fascinating is that these policies, they tend to implement them in one local area first and see how they work. And they test them in a local area. And if the result is effective, they then will start to gradually implement them on a national level. And that they tried out something like a social credit system, and they tried it out in a local area. And some of the more negative things we're hearing about were some of the attempts in local areas that didn't go over so well. A lot of what we're hearing in U.S. media is very exaggerated. I don't think that the Chinese government is punishing people for buying too much liquor or anything like that. But I think that they are trying to assess who who in the business community is the most loyal to their visions. And based on that, who will receive government support, who will get government contracts, because the Chinese state is the biggest factor in the economy. And the state needs to make a determination about who it's in its best interest to do business with. And I think that's the idea. You know, when you go and get a loan, you have a credit score. The bank determines whether or not you're trustworthy to pay back your loan, how much your rate of interest is going to be. I think the Chinese government is making that determination when it comes to figures in the business community that it would like to do business with. It's determining how loyal they are to the party's overall vision, how trustworthy they are, and based on that, how much the Chinese state will invest in them.
Well, Kenneth, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. That was Caleb Maupin, journalist and political analyst and who frequently appears on RT International. He writes on American foreign policy and is the creator and founder of the Center for Political Innovation. We were talking there about why does China matter? We'll go now to Angela with weather and traffic.
Good morning. Commuters can expect a smooth trip this morning as no active delays are reported on any subway lines right now. For the LARRR, there are also no delays being reported at this time. Today, extra service will be added for customers leaving work in the early afternoon in observance of Yom Kippur. 10 additional eastbound trains will depart Penn Station between 12:43 p.m. and 3:48 p.m., and one local train to Hicksville will extend to Huntington. For bridge and tunnel traffic, the Lincoln and Holland tunnels are both experiencing bumper-to-bumper delays headed into the city this morning. There's bumper-to-bumper traffic on the GW headed north on both the upper and lower levels. The upper-level traffic is leading into the city. Construction continues on the Verrazano Bridge today, so be prepared for traffic to slow down if you're headed that way this morning. We're seeing backups on both the Whitestone and Throgs Neck Bridges headed south as well. For road traffic, the LIE is experiencing heavy backups headed westbound starting in Suffolk and leading into Queens. The Staten Island Expressway getting onto the Verrazano is experiencing heavy traffic as well, leading onto the Gowanus Expressway. An accident was just reported on the Grand Central Parkway headed east, causing heavy delays headed toward LaGuardia Airport. There's heavy traffic in the Bronx this morning on the Bruckner Expressway headed west, the Cross Bronx headed south, and the Major Deegan headed south. If you can, take the clear view this morning if you're headed that way. The Cross Island headed north is experiencing delays. Finally, for today's weather, it's mostly sunny with a high near 84 and humidity around 86%. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms are possible before 10 p.m. with a low around 71. Thursday, there's a chance of showers with thunderstorms also possible after 4 p.m. with a high near 76.
Have you been on America? Just you and your idol, civil sense so loud. Make me break down and cry. Oh,
and welcome back
to What's Going On. That was David Bowie, Young Americans. This is Rebecca Miles, the host of What's Going On. You're tuned to WBAI, Pacifica Radio, 99.5 FM in New York City. We go now to the second interview for this morning to talk about the East River Park and the Lower East Side. As many of you know, the Lower East Side, well, a lot of New York was flooded during Hurricane Sandy, prompting the city to consider flood mitigation plans that, and one of them would affect the East River Park. Joining me on the show is Eileen Miles, one of the lead members of a group, East River Park Action, that's fighting to stop the city from destroying the only park on the Lower East Side. The city has allegedly contracted to remove the park in its entirety, close to 1,000 trees, and then to construct from landfill a 10-foot mound, cover it with astroturf and plant samplings, ignoring that this is a landing for many migratory birds, the home to dozens of squirrels and local birds, a respite from the heat for the many people, certainly during the COVID pandemic, a place to go for just to breathe. And so welcome to the show, Eileen.
Hi, Rebecca. Good to be here. Good morning.
Yes, thank you very much. Yeah. So here we are in September. The dates I've seen are October 2021 as the start of this demolition. But there's a lawsuit pending. So where are we? What's happening?
Well, the city literally has given, given themselves a notice to proceed. And that's against all kinds of resistance, even within the city. I mean, Scott Stringer, who the comptroller, received the contract from this very thrown together company. I mean, there were very few bids. They were looking for bids for 5 years, and only two companies came forward. And one of them doesn't fulfill the requirements the city asked for the kind of company, but they gave them this contract. And when Stringer looked at the contract, he had many questions and sent it back to the DDC. But de Blasio just steamrolled over it. De Blasio seems to have this idea that this will, replacing John Lindsay Park with de Blasio Park, will make him a great man in the future, or that it's the trust fund for whatever happens to him after he's mayor, because he's certainly going to be, it was a joke that he was running for president, and it's a bigger joke that he would be governor when the people of the city despise this man. So we're, you know, this plan seems to be going forward with for no good reason, with no support, except that you know, the DDC, which is run by a guy named Jamie Torres Springer, who comes straight from a real estate consultancy called HR&A that just is all over the city planning. I mean, it's kind of it looks like a lobbyist that just kind of, you leave New York City government and you go to HR&A and then you leave HR&A. In fact, Torres Springer he got an approval that he could still make profit on HR&A once he worked for the city, which just thought, put up, what a red flag that is. I mean, you want to make sure you're making money on what, Jamie? And when one of our numbers called the Parks Department in a kind of faux naive way, just to hear what they would say, they talked to the current person running it, who's not only not a green guy, he's like a publicist from the New School, Sam Biedermeier, and he kept going, flood rising, sea level rise. And she kept interrogating him. It was clear he didn't know what he was talking about. And finally, he just went, oh, it's just Jamie's project. So this is kind of a dude thing. Jamie's, you know, Jamie wants to do this. Bill wants to do it. You know, Carlina signed on. We have a city councilor who's, you know, people love her or did love her because she was born and bred in the neighborhood, you know, grew up on Rivington Street and has just came into office and is one of those progressives who goes for every real estate thing you put in front of her nose. So she was on the right side with the park. And then suddenly, when it came time for the city council to vote, and there was 90 minutes of testimony, and all of it was against the plan, environmentalists, people in the neighborhood, and then the city council just went for it. I mean, after it was proven that it was a bad plan, they were like, let's vote for that. And Carlina Rivera joined their ranks. So it just really stinks. And there's been so much, close to 20,000 petitions, you know, and we just get stonewalled at every step of the way.
So are you going to court? Is there a lawsuit pending in court?
There's two lawsuits. Yeah, and one is about something called alienation, which has to do with, if you're going to do something like this, you have to get the state to declare alienation, so that would be transparency, that would be, you know, benefits. I mean, it's not the ideal, but it's a lawsuit that could stop them, you know, and we already lost that, and now we're appealing, you know, because they're saying this is a park purpose. And the other lawsuit is about a document when they came up with this crazy ass plan, and that's not a swear ass, right? Or is it borderline?
Well, no, it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah. They came up with this crazy, I mean, because it was a community plan, as we know, that was, you know, there in place in 2018 and funded by HUD and funded potentially by the city, and suddenly there was silence, and then the amazing hiring of Jamie Torres Springer. He's a figure to watch. And then the city announced that they had the newer, better, faster plan. And
more expensive.
And more, I mean, up $1.5 billion then. And now we know it's upward $2 billion. You know, so it's such an irrational plan, and the rationale for it, was something called the Value Engineering Report, which I guess anybody who does engineering knows about. It's basically something that says how much bang you get for your buck. Mm-hmm. And they refused to show, this was the reason why they're doing it, and they refused to show it to the community. And then half a year later, Carlina Rivera was insisting there was no such document. It was just kind of a way of talking about workshops. And then after that, they said they couldn't find it. And then after that, we began our suit. And then they gave us a completely redacted plan. And then we pushed again, and they gave us a slightly less redacted plan. But the plan, basically, there are plenty of objections in it and lots of debate, and even who was there in the room when this plan, because this plan was hashed in secrecy. And the worst part is, such a character as Jamie Torres Springer was around before Sandy. They were both beautiful plans for the city's coastline before Sandy, which have been ignored. And there were also sneaky plans that de Blasio was hatching before Sandy. So this feels like, Sandy feels like the Reichstag fire for certain real estate figures in this city, because suddenly Sandy, you know, and they let the community come up with a beautiful plan that wouldn't destroy the park. And then they were, we've got something better, faster for you. This was in the air.
So the community plan I heard of was to build some, I guess, the U around the island. So this would go along the FDR and create a barricade to stop the flow of water, except water is not necessarily can be directed. It goes where it wants to go. So that's great if another Hurricane Sandy hits at the exact same spot. But what are we talking about? This is Mother Nature. She does what she wants.
Exactly. And it doesn't do, this plan doesn't do anything for rain. It doesn't do anything for rain. And it's been pointed out that like what the city really ought to do when people really start drowning in their apartments is suspend all city contracts until you do a real look at the water and sewer infrastructure, because that's what's wrong. You know, and the figures they use even for this construction are from 2008. Mm. And they've not renewed this plan since the pandemic. So they've done no environmental study. There hasn't been anything outside of the city. In fact, they haven't let the state look at it. They haven't let the feds look at it. You know, this is all cooked up in the hen house, you know. So it's complete madness. You know, I mean, it's so weird that the city would be saying that we're doing this, you know, because of, you know, saving lives. Meanwhile, Staten Island, where people did drown during Sandy, is surrounded by wetlands. And as you probably know, there's a poor neighborhood called Graniteville surrounded by wetlands. And the city is putting in a big box store, not the city, but they've allowed BJ's big box store, and destroying the wetlands even as we speak. And so they love to talk about environmental justice neighborhoods, which the Lower East Side is, and which Graniteville on Staten Island is, and then we get the most non-green, the most violating environmental plans. I mean, there's a different plan all along Manhattan. That's what's really crazy. Like, there were no fatalities in the Lower East Side in Sandy. And I think there was something like 3 feet of, I mean, it wasn't, you know, clearly there was flooding in the neighborhood, But the park is resilient. The park flooded and the water went back to the river. Mm-hmm. But down in Battery Park, they had like 6 feet of flooding and they're getting wetlands and glass gates. And Hoboken, who got money at the same time as we did in 2012, has built the thing already. They have this very various way combination of wetlands and walls where they need it. They have not destroyed anything. There's no place else in Manhattan where there's such a large scale destruction. It just smells like real estate. You can't look at the West Side and look at the East Side and not say that this poor neighborhood's park is being taken away because of something very, it's very Robert Moses in the worst way, right? Mm-hmm.
I think we'll go to a bit of music now and see if there have got any callers this morning. The number to call is, I can't find the number, is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. We're talking to Eileen Miles, who's one of the members of the East River Park Action, who's fighting to stop the city from destroying the only park on the Lower East Side. I should stress that. It's like a mile and a quarter. Not much, but my God, did it provide respite during COVID? Even from the heat in the summer, you go over to the park and it's like 10 degrees cooler. It's like a great big air conditioning unit. And that's not even considering the actual life that lives there permanently, birds and squirrels and trees, nearly 1,000 trees, which they want to tear down. Some of them have been, they're 50 years old. It's a tragedy. 80.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a tragedy, a real tragedy. And it just is madness. Madness. And welcome back to the show. We're talking to Eileen Miles, one of the members of the East River Park Action, who's fighting to try and stop the city from destroying the only park on the Lower East Side. In the break there, we were just talking about trees.
Mm-hmm.
So you were saying that some of them are as old as 70 years old, but what else can you say about the trees there?
Well, they're replacing in this crazy plan. They're building, as you said earlier, a concrete levee, topping it with AstroTurf and 12 tennis courts for some new people who don't live there yet. And then putting in, they say, even more trees, saplings. But it's been demonstrated that mature trees are 70 times more productive in terms of cleaning the air than a sapling. There's just no comparison between almost 1,000 trees, so many of which are 40 and 50 and 80 years old. And it's next to FDR and in this public housing right there. You know, de Blasio loves to cite the public housing. We're saving lives. We're helping these people. But I don't think that he's ever asked these people. They're just used as the chorus for patheticness so that he can rescue them. And also, so it, we're going to create so much CO2 and heat. And heat is the number one weather-related cause of death in the city. Heat is the number one, you know. And so what you were saying, too, it's like, what happens when you have all concrete, no trees, and hot, hot air and CO2? And, you know, and 100,000 people before the pandemic use this park a year. Mm. I mean, during the pandemic, it may have been, I don't know if anybody did the figures, but it may have been twice that number. And we're still in a pandemic. And this park is what, I mean, I grew up in this neighborhood. I mean, not like I came here when I was in my 20s. But at the time when I was changing my life and needing exercise rather than drugs and alcohol, I started jogging down there and I couldn't afford a gym. You know, this is the gym for people who can't afford a gym. This is the vacation for people who can't afford a vacation. You know, de Blasio was in Maine and Massachusetts this summer. We were tracking him, you know, and the park rolled on.
Yeah. And
you've held barbecues outside City Hall. You've had cocktails outside Rivera's office. You've locked arms around trees. You've had multiple meetings and protests. What else is in the future? Are you going to have to chain yourself to the trees? Is this where we're heading?
Oh, it is. I think we're definitely heading towards direct action. And the worst part is that's what the media is inviting. You know, I think that there was one publication that was very interested in writing about us on our, we did a thing on September 11th, which is 1,000 people, 1,000 trees. You know, we wanted to honor the event by looking at the loss that will come, you know, and, we were told that we couldn't, that they were interested in writing about it. And this is bigger publications, but they were going to wait until we chain ourselves to trees. So right. They're kind of letting it get worse. And the kind of unwillingness of the media to do anything that resembles advocacy, you know, as if this is an act of nature, what the mayor wants. I mean, his talking points dominate the news. I mean, I personally, I'm a writer. I tried to write, I wrote several, op-eds for the New York Times, and they all said, this is local. This is local news. We don't do local, you know? And I thought, how is the biggest city in North America losing the only park in the tip of Manhattan? And again, how could that be local news? This is, if it happens here, it'll happen all over North America. It is happening all over North America. It's a test because nothing this big has ever been done before. It really is special and unique. And if they can push this through against environmental testimony and against justice, environmental justice, and against the will of the people, they can do anything, you know. And this is a big company, HRNA, that Jamie's project comes from, you know.
So what's next? Do you have something coming up this weekend?
Well, I think we you know, I think the group is at odds. There are parts of the group that want to, like, engage the community and tell people things. And there are parts of the group that want to, like, be in camping in the park. I think there's something going on in the park. If you want to, like, barbecue and be at the last house music in the amphitheater, it's the last permanent event is happening from 12 to 8. So come and dance and see the park that was. And we'll be there leafleting and passing out information. And whether there's some direct action or not is still being debated right now. But, I mean, many of us are game and ready to go. And I think other people are saying no, no, no. Because, you know, it's affecting the community, you know, the most. And it still is. I don't know if you've ever seen you probably have seen the Russian film Solaris that Tarkovsky made. And in the beginning of the film, it opens with this very idyllic scene in which the astronaut is walking through the lands of his dacha. And it's just like nature and bloom and just, and then he gets on a, you know, spaceship and takes off and leaves the Earth. And when you go to that park, you see something that feels just like that. Everybody's laughing and fishing and playing, and they just don't know. You know, I think, and that's the dilemma of our group, that unlike Black Lives Matter, where the horrible thing has happened and keeps happening, you know, and we have evidence. Someone has been killed. The park has not been killed yet. And if you listen to the city, they're renovating it. They're going to, I mean, the parks department, department says they're giving us more trees. It's going to be even better. And we who live in the neighborhood know that, like, when they replaced the Esplanade, which is the path along the river, they said it would take 2 years. They closed the park for 10.
Yeah.
So to destroy the whole park, which they say will happen in 3 or 4 years, we say 10 or 15, you know, there will be no shade there for 30 years. That means, and there will be no Little League. 300 kids play Little League in those fields.
I'm going to have to wrap it up there.
Yes. Eileen, I'm really sorry. Going forward, on tomorrow's show with Felipe Luciano. Next up is Democracy Now! Thank you for listening. You were listening then to Eileen Miles, one of the members of the group East River Park Action. Try and look up them up on the web, fighting to stop the city from destroying the only park on the Lower East Side. Thank you very much for joining me on the show this morning, very early that it was.
Yeah,
thank you, Michael. Thank you, Michael, for engineering this morning, and I'll be back next Wednesday.
Terrific. Thank you.
There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. War is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see
what's going on.
What's going on?
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 I was sitting there listening to him give his State of the State address, and my jaw dropped.
I thought it was wrong for a number of people to blindside me the day of the vote.
We have a schizophrenic healthcare philosophy.
This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette.
And I'm Jarrett Murphy from City Limits. If you want to understand more about the challenges facing New York City and hear from people running for office or working on solutions, tune in to Max and Murphy. We'll talk to electeds and candidates, experts and advocates, and then open up the phone lines to hear from you. That's Max and Murphy, Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
You're listening to WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. And it's now just Ben Max. Jared Murphy is pursuing a nursing career, so it's just Ben